You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration is preparing to hold military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay for non-U.S. citizens accused of alleged terrorist acts. Procedures are already underway for an execution chamber in the corner of Cuba controlled by the U.S. Human Rights Watch, in a press release on Friday, recommended that military commissions should not be used to try terrorist suspects unless the rules are significantly changed. Peace Watch spoke with the U.S. Policy Director of Human Rights Watch, Wendy Patton, about what rules specifically need to be changed.
The Defense Department issued a set of 8 instructions that set out all the rules that explain how the commissions will actually work. They issued those at the end of April. So after carefully reviewing them, we have concluded that the commission rules need to be significantly changed before they try anyone because they won't produce fair trials that meet international standards. And there are a number of different problems that we've highlighted, and I'll just mention a few. One of them is the lack of independent judicial oversight. The rules limit appellate review of the commission decisions to a specially created military panel, which is appointed by the Secretary of Defense. And then President Bush has final review of commission convictions and sentences. So what that means is there's no appeal by an independent civilian court, which is outside the military chain of command. That means that the executive branch is prosecutor, judge, jury, and potentially executioner.
Is this something that has been created just in the aftermath of 9/11, for example, or is this the way these military commissions have been run all along?
Well, it stands very much in contrast to, for example, courts-martial, whereas when members of the U.S. Armed Forces are tried in courts-martial, although those are military, you know, those are military officials, they have a right of appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, which is an independent civilian court, and on up to the Supreme Court. That difference in treatment between the people who might be subjected to these military commissions, all of whom are non-citizens, and what goes on in the courts martial is especially significant if the commissions are used for people who should have been considered prisoners of war, such as the Taliban fighters who are members of the regular armed forces of the then government of Afghanistan. Under the Geneva Conventions, they are to be tried by the same courts using the same procedures as members of the U.S. military. But obviously, these procedures are very different because there's no civilian appeal.
Mm-hmm. So you were identifying several problems with these commissions. Mm-hmm. Did you complete your thought?
There are a couple of other ones that I think are significant to highlight. The way the rules are written, they will restrict the right to counsel of one's choice. The commission rules require defendants to be represented by military defense counsel. Now, they can have a civilian counsel on their defense team at their own expense, but they have to have the military lawyer. So they can't have the counsel of their own choice, and they couldn't choose to represent themselves. And that's an important part of the right to counsel, is this idea of the right to counsel of one's choice. Similarly, it will deprive defense counsel of the means to prepare an effective defense because of a whole host of severe limitations on where lawyers can travel, who they can communicate with in order to interview potential witnesses and do research for the case.
So now Human Rights Watch says this violates the basic rights of the accused. Mm-hmm. Give us an example of how that might play out in the real world.
Sure. Well, I think one example has to do with who could be subjected to this court. The rules as written are going to improperly subject criminal suspects to military trials. The military commissions will be permitted to try persons who were never combatants and whose connection to armed conflict may be tenuous at best. So, for example, a non-U.S. citizen living in the United States who has financially contributed to Al-Qaeda could be prosecuted before the commission for aiding and abetting the enemy. At Human Rights Watch, our strong view is that with the U.S. courts fully functioning, there's no justification for subjecting civilians to military trial and violating their right to a hearing by an independent and impartial tribunal.
Now, these are for individuals who have been aiding and abetting Al-Qaeda?
Or, for example, maybe someone who, it depends on how these rules will be interpreted, but the connection between terrorist activities and aiding and abetting terrorist activities and the armed conflict is loose in the rules, so that as opposed to someone who was clearly a combatant and arrested on the battlefield and being charged for violations of the laws of war, you could have someone who was in the United States, perhaps made a contribution to a group that was involved some way in supporting terrorism, and that that person could be subjected to the military commissions instead of being tried in a regular criminal court of the United States for any crimes they may have committed. We strongly hope that the Defense Department will take a look at the criticisms of the rules, which are coming not only from us at human rights groups, but also from military justice experts, in the hopes that they'll significantly revise these rules before they put anyone on trial.
And these rules violate international due process standards, according to your Human Rights Watch report. How far afield are they from other military commissions, say, that are used by other countries around the world?
That's a good question. I don't know that I can give you an assessment of other kinds of military commissions, but one thing that is clear is that under international human rights law, human rights bodies have taken a rather skeptical view of military commissions, precisely because they are often used as a way to provide a lesser standard of justice. The Human Rights Committee of the UN has said that the use of military courts to try civilians could present serious problems as far as equitable, impartial, and independent administration of justice is concerned. So I think the real question here is the eyes of the world are going to be on the United States when it conducts these trials, which are very likely to be held at Guantanamo Bay. And it's a world that is in large measure skeptical or concerned about the long-term detention of people at Guantanamo. So for the verdicts that are and the sentences issued by these trials to be considered legitimate, they have to guarantee the basic rights of the defendants. Mm. Right now, the rules don't do that.
In very strong language, the Human Rights Watch report asserted that some detainees, such as the Taliban at Guantanamo Bay, should be treated as POWs. Can you explain for our audience what the difference is between a potential terrorist and the Taliban detainees?
Sure. What we have criticized in terms of the status of the detainees is the blanket determination that no one at Guantanamo Bay was eligible for prisoner of war status. The Geneva Conventions require that that determination be made on an individualized basis by a special tribunal. The fact that that wasn't done means that these people were denied their right to that kind of individualized determination, which in our view would have properly led to the conclusion that the members of the Taliban armed forces, not the Al-Qaeda folks, but the Taliban armed forces, would have been eligible for prisoner of war status. It's probably correct that Al-Qaeda members are not eligible for POW status, but the Taliban forces should be considered POWs.
Wendy Patton, U.S. Policy Director of Human Rights Watch. The basic rights of individuals labeled as enemy aliens have come under assault under provisions in the U.S. Patriot Act and Homeland Security measures. Georgetown University law professor David Cole, delivering a speech recently at the University of Massachusetts Boston College, describes how the laws take on a sort of mission creep into the rights of U.S. citizens.
1919 was a very scary time in America. World War I had successfully concluded, but that left a depression on the domestic home front. There was massive unemployment as the troops came back and there weren't jobs for them. There were, in that year alone, 3,600 strikes across the nation involving 4 million workers, many of them violent. The Communist Party had taken over the Soviet Union and several Eastern European countries and was threatening to take over some Western European countries. And this was all sort of came to a head in the summer of 1919 with a series of terrorist bombings, mail bombs delivered or directed to people like Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, to the Attorney General of the United States, to the Postmaster General of the United States, to several senators, to John D. Rockefeller. Most of them were intercepted en route, but several were not and led to very serious injuries. That was then followed 1 month later by the bombing of the Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer's home, personal home, in Washington, D.C. The bomber managed to explode off the entire front of the Attorney General's home. The government's response was to launch something that are now known as the Palmer Raids. It went out and rounded up between 4,000 and 10,000 foreign nationals. It charged them not with being involved in the bombings, not with criminal or terrorist conduct, but with political association, with association with various communist parties. It held them in detention. It interrogated them without lawyers, coerced their confessions, and then used those confessions against them. And ultimately, some 800 were deported. One of the people who was involved in that period, writing about it afterwards, described it in these words. He said that the delirium caused by the bombings moved in the direction of a deportation crusade with all the spontaneity of water seeking out the course of least resistance. And I think that's much of what we see today, the course of least resistance. Because while the attacks of September 11th have left all of us feeling vulnerability in ways that we never felt vulnerable before, and while that new vulnerability does suggest that we need to rethink the balance between liberty and security, for the most part, the government has not, in fact, asked us to do that. It hasn't asked us to make the hard choice of which of our liberties do we want to give up in the name of some increase in security. Instead, for the most part, what it has done is to say, we will give up their liberties for your security, they being foreign nationals and specifically Arab and Muslim foreign nationals. And that's an easy way to strike the balance if you're a politician because, of course, foreign nationals have no vote, have no voice in the political process. So we put on this balance between liberty and security all, everybody's security concerns and the liberty concerns of a voiceless, voteless foreign national minority. Now, what I want to suggest is what we do to foreign nationals in the name of security will ultimately come back to haunt us because it will be extended to U.S. citizens. This notion that your rights aren't at stake, only their rights are at stake. Three examples. First example goes back to this period of 1919 and the Palmer Raids that I talked about. The architect of the Palmer Raids targeted, remember, at foreign nationals and only at foreign nationals because they were the course of least resistance. His name was J. Edgar Hoover. And he went, and as I argue in my forthcoming book, Enemy Aliens, first jobs can be habit-forming. He went on from that, spent the rest of his career in the FBI seeking to extend to the citizenry the kinds of powers that he had enjoyed exerting over alien radicals during the Palmer Raids. And in the McCarthy era, which Ellen Schrecker, probably the preeminent historian of that period, argues should be called the Hoover era, because he was much more central to it than McCarthy was, he succeeded. And we extended the exact same tactics to citizens, guilt by association, the use of administrative processes, denying people the right, fair opportunity to defend themselves, and the like. And tens of thousands of Americans lost their jobs, had their reputations ruined, went to jail for their political associations. Second example, the Japanese internment of World War II, probably the most shameful period other than slavery in our history. That didn't come out of nowhere. It was an extension to citizens. In the internment, 110,000 people were locked up because of their race, 70,000 of them U.S. citizens of Japanese descent. And it was an extension to the citizenry of the enemy alien practice, which goes back to 1798 and says during a war you can lock up a national of the country with which we're at war without showing that he's engaged in any kind of dangerous, nefarious criminal activity. And the argument is, you know, during a war, the president's got to have this power. You got to presume they're loyal to the country of their citizenship. And we can't make fine distinctions. In this crisis, we have already seen this happen. Remember, when it was introduced, Dick Cheney gets on and says, when a foreigner comes and attacks us, he doesn't deserve the same rights and guarantees that an American citizen does. Well, at that time, we thought all these people were foreign nationals. Then we discovered one of the people on Guantanamo, Yasser Hamdi, was an American citizen because he had been born here. And we are today treating him in exactly the same way, holding him in military custody as an enemy combatant on the president's word without a charge, without a hearing, without a trial, incommunicado, without access to a lawyer. The final example is taken from Patriot Act II, one provision of which would strip U.S. citizens, including native-born citizens, of their citizenship if they are found to have ties to a quote-unquote terrorist organization. So now we are actually going to turn citizens into non-citizens, and then they will be subject to all the measures that I have talked about. So for reasons of self-interest, For reasons of security, and most importantly for reasons of principle, we should resist the temptation to strike the balance between liberty and security on the backs of the most vulnerable among us, the most voiceless among us, foreign nationals.
David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University Law School. Thanks to Mark Weaver of community radio station WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for production assistance with that piece. Imagine internet-animated mini-movies or slideshows depicting pictures of American war atrocities on the people of Iraq, using idealistic quotes from American military and civilian leaders. Political cartoonist Eric Bloomrich has created a series of shorts that explore conditions in Iraq in the aftermath of the U.S. campaign of shock and awe. In the next segment, Stephen Donovan of Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley interviews Eric Bloomrich.
I think I've been political my entire life. My parents were hippies of the 60s generation, and I was raised with just a lot of input where that was concerned. I was doing volunteer work for the Mondale campaign back in 1984. I became politically aware, I'd have to say, about the Reagan administration. That's when I really woke up to it, because about the time of the 1982 economic recession, they called it, I just started to realize how bad people were off in this country and how little the government was doing about it and how much we were spending on the military and such. And I just discovered, you know, this is wrong.
On your site, there are at least right now 11 animations, and one of them, Liberation, shows pictures of dead Iraqi citizens contrasted with quotes from U.S. generals and other people from the U.S. administration, including President Bush. And there are a number of images of Iraqi or Arab citizens burning United States flags, Iraqis mobilizing mass resistance protests. What is the message that you're trying to convey?
That the quote-unquote liberation of Iraq was not a liberation. Even though the Bush administration now has changed its tune and said that it was not about weapons of mass destruction, they're now saying, well, we liberated Iraq. It's really a military occupation. Right now we're hearing reports about how cholera and other diseases are spreading like wildfire because, quite frankly, the United States is too busy securing the oil reserves over there to actually do anything about the public services such as water, sewage, sanitation, and such.
One of the things that I think jumps out in your animations is this incredible contrast that you have with the rhetoric of the administration with other voices. For example, one of the lines you have from Brigadier General John Kelly is, "We'll shoot them down like the morons they are." And you contrast this with a quote from a person you mentioned as Yarub al-Sadun with, "Is this freedom that you bring us? All you come here for is to kill innocent people. You bring us death." And watching these animations, it is incredible the way in which the hypocrisy of the Bush administration is really exposed. Why has not this message caught on with the majority of people?
There are a whole bunch of factors in that. Number one, a minority of Americans have computers, and a minority of those who have computers are on the internet. I think worldwide, the number of people who are on the internet is roughly equivalent to the population of the United States. So that's why my animations are getting across and why this information isn't getting across, because really the only place that this information is getting wide exposure is on the internet. All of the networks and such will not point these things out because, of course, we know that this administration was installed by the very media companies that generate all the news that Americans see. And, of course, they aren't going to be putting any of this information forward because that would be jeopardizing their investment.
In your animation Victory, you have haunting black and white pictures of children killed, wounded, corpses partially buried in the sands, numerous hospital images, and with a quote from Joseph Goebbels, which culminates into like a virtual bombardment of images sliding in and out. And then there's a long quote from Martin Luther King and a still picture of him. And I was wondering what Martin Luther King means to you and why was his message so prominently featured in this piece?
It's kind of hard to put into words. He was a fantastic American, a true patriot, a guy who worked for the betterment of mankind as a whole. And it's a pity that he died before his Poor People's Campaign was able to be launched in full force, which I think would have been his greatest contribution. Because from what I've read, near the end of his tragically shortened life, he realized that the system here in America was not just oppressing the blacks, it was oppressing all people. And that's what he was going to do. He was going to lead, I think, several million people to Washington and literally occupy the city until they shut it down and force the Congress to take action on these issues. What he did for the minority communities here in the United States is nothing short of saintly. So, I mean, to me personally, like I said, it's kind of hard to put into words. It's sort of like asking what I think about the moon or what I think about the sunset. It's such a big thing. A couple of days prior to doing this animation, I had heard this anti-war speech that Martin Luther King had given in respect to the Vietnam War. And I thought this would be a really great way to end this animation, because at the very end of the animation, it has a quote by George Bush saying that it has fallen to America to make the world safe. And we see that's not what the United States is doing. If anything else, we're making it more unsafe. And that particular excerpt I used from that speech was a good counterbalance to what Bush had said. I mean, from what I understand, Bobby Kennedy was considering for him to be his vice presidential candidate. And it makes you think, when you go back in history, how far we've fallen, how much good that could have brought about in this country, and how far we have sunk since then. Now we have a guy that gets up and says just blatantly Orwellian things like, when I'm talking about war, I'm really talking about peace. That's just absurd.
The animation War Crimes was actually the first time that I had bumped into your animations, and I found it while getting my daily dose of news on BuzzFlash. It's an unbelievably powerful animation that begins with the Rome Statute of the International Court, Article 8. Then this animation goes into dozens of pictures of blown up buildings, quotes from Cheney that the United States forces will be greeted as liberators, and showing U.S. soldiers abusing Iraqi civilians, demonstrating American aggression. The animation ends with the statement, "Mr. Bush, their blood is on your hands. You have shamed our nation, stolen our government, and soiled our flag with the blood of children. We will never forget, and we will never forgive, laid atop an American flag." What was the response to this message, if any, in particular?
Actually, I did have to change the ending of that. It originally ended with just another photograph. The very ending, "We Shall Never Forgive," was superimposed over another photograph of one of the American atrocities that were perpetrated over there. And I got some email from people saying, you know, considering the climate here in the United States, that's a little bit stepping over the line. And as much as I don't like editing myself or holding myself back from my opinions, I will have to say that they did have a point. I replaced it with an American flag to give it more of a patriotic feel to it, more because really I consider myself a patriot.
Not everybody has loved your animations. I think that you got some emails that prompted you to respond to these kind of hate mail. Obviously, if anybody looks at the site, they can go back and find the animation where you're responding to your critics. But can you just explain how much people are expressing their disapproval as much as their approval? And what level, in terms of critical analysis, are these responses taking?
Without exception, I'd have to say that all of the negative emails I've gotten are 50% four-letter words, insults, profanity, just inarticulate rage is what it is. I haven't seen much critical analysis. I think a couple of weeks ago, I said on my site, "I'm willing to debate you guys. Send me an email. I'll post it up on my site, and we'll go head-to-head, and I'll dedicate a page on my site to you guys." And after a couple of days after that, I just realized it's pointless with these people. Whenever they see something like what I'm doing or what BuzzFlash is doing or something like that, it's so different from what they're getting from the TV, it's hard for them to understand.
You also do an animation, Memorial, which is a very powerful animation that plays very solemn music and lists the names of 151 fallen soldiers. The animation also says that these men and women fought to make obscenely rich men richer, to allow madmen to pursue dreams of empire and to look for weapons of mass destruction that weren't there, to liberate a country that America destroyed and will dominate for years to come. In essence, your site notes that they died for lies. You also have links to veteran sites, and I'm wondering how the veteran connection came about, and maybe how has the response been, and whether there were any kind of discussions about the content.
People had been suggesting to me for a while that I should mention something about these soldiers that were sent over there for extremely prurient reasons. And I said, yeah, I'll think about it. And then I took a look at the list of the number of soldiers that were killed. And I started noticing that 95% of these people were younger than me. About 50% of them were just 18 or 19 years old. These were kids. And I, as much as I think that the military is a necessary evil, I just felt that something should be said about this.
Eric Blumrich is a 32-year-old web graphics designer and animator and the creator of ericblumrich.com, a.k.a. buzzflash.com. He was speaking with Stephen Donovan of Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California. Thanks to Reem Kathuda for production assistance with that segment.
Culture of war, cut back on the oil that it kills folks for.
As long as there's greed, there can be no peace. Imperialist bloodshed simply must cease.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer today was R.H. Brown. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammond of KPFA, Todd Bachman of This American Life, Eddie Becker, and James Garrett. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.
And racist bloodshed on which fascists feed.
Into battles for homes and hell, soften up enemies to liberate our wealth.